Hello, we're going to, in this podcast, go over the astrophysics section of an exam which is about 2 years ago, 2016. And the general purpose of this has been for my cardiac rehab, not for you, unfortunately. But as I get feedback, I'll do things slightly differently to make it more available for other audiences. So what I'm going to do is something that you should do is go through the formula sheet that you will be given in the exam first and actually go through it. So I'll do that first and then we'll go through the questions. And before I do the question, I have a quick read of it and teach it first and then actually do the actual answer to the question. See about how that goes. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I'm trying to teach or discuss, review things scientific. Now, let's go through the formula sheet. And the first formula relates to the distance of a star in relation to the angle it moves, the half angle that it actually moves. So this is the apparent shift of the angle that it moves between, say, January and July, a full year away. So its actual distance that the Earth has moved is 2 atomic units. And the half angle is something we measure as in seconds of arc, which is a very small small angle. So a degree, a 60th of a degree is a minute, and a second is 60 divided by 60 for a second, and that's got the symbol of P. D is a distance, but that distance is given in something called parsec. So a parsec is equivalent to about 3.2 light years. So the formula, drum roll, is D equals 1 on P. So the smaller the angle, the greater the distance it is through, and that P is in seconds of arc. The next formula relates the number attached to the brightness of a star, given it's called the magnitude. We've got absolute and apparent magnitude. So absolute magnitude is, if you get any star in the universe and you actually bring it such as 10 parsecs, or about 32 light years, 32.6 light years if I remember away, put it there, they will be there, that brightness will be equivalent to a magnitude scale. The magnitude scale actually is lifted up from the ancient Greeks, in actual fact, and they said, had a numbering system, and 5 units of the magnitude scale actually corresponded roughly to a factor of 100 times in brightness. So this led to the following formula: M, the absolute magnitude, equals the apparent magnitude, small m, minus 5 times the log of base 10 d on 10. And what that means is that D is the distance to the star, and M are these relative numbers which we have sort of made more scientific. So we've taken the ancient records, the records from the Middle Ages and beyond, which had the magnitude of stars as a numbering system, and we've translated that into some more hard science. And then we've said, look, the stars are different distances away. I can go through the derivation of that, but D on 10, so if it is 10 parsecs away, which is 32 light years away, big M equals little m, or the absolute equals the apparent. There's a minus 5 5 on there, because you've got essentially for every bracket of 100, there's historically 5 units of magnitude, so that 5 is a historical one given us to the ancient Greeks, and you don't have a inverse square law because there's a 2 in there which is divided through. If you do logarithms, it's divided by 2. I'll put these formulas up on the net. The next one is I star A on I star B, so the relative intensity of 2 stars, the intensity as you measure through a machine, so you don't know what the machine, the relative intensity of, you measure 2 stars, and that equals the formula of 100, the apparent magnitude of B minus the apparent magnitude of A, all divided by 5. Again, the 5 is a historical number from the ancient Greeks. So IA, the ratio of IA on IB equals 100 to the following, small mb minus small ma divided by 5. So that's three formulas. That's four formulas that we're given. The next one is m1 plus m2 equals 4 pi squared r cubed on big G t squared. And that's really Kepler's law, which is rearranged for you. And it says for a binary star, which has a mission radius between, they're orbiting at a distance between, and they have a period, you can work out their combined mass. So I'll read that to you again. M1 plus M2 equals 4 pi squared r cubed on gt squared. So that's a manipulation of the Kepler's law of periods, which goes r cubed on t squared equals g big M of the thing you're orbiting on 4 pi squared. So that comes across from that one. Okay, this is astrophysics stuff, and it says I'll just read the question. This is A, part 1, for 2 marks, it's out of 25. Distinguish between the terms resolution and sensitivity as applied to optical telescopes. So, just using the reverse order of answering questions. In optical telescopes, resolution refers to the angular separation that you can make out between two stars. So it's this, the resolution of a telescope is the smallest angle that you can say, look, there are two stars separately. So it's not two distinct stars, it's a star with a different, you can pick out there are two separate stars and what they are within one bigger star. Whereas the sensitivity refers to the dimmest amount of light that can actually be detected through it. And I'll read the answer to you. Resolution of optical telescope is the ability to distinguish two close objects as separate images. Okay. Sensitivity is a light gathering power and the ability to detect faint objects for observation. This depends on, well, it says this depends on the area of the mirror, the light gathering things. Two, outline ways of improving the resolution of ground-based telescopes. So there are two ways of resolving resolution. This is technically removing the natural blur of something by improving the quality of the telescope. So if the mirror is more perfect and the optics are more perfect, it will actually give you a less blurry image. So you can do that by having a atmospheric compensation. Apparently that's not such a strong answer. The other way of resolving resolution is by diffraction limiting, i.e. that the difference between two spots are determined by the wave refraction of the aperture. So you can increase the aperture of this, and you can increase the effective aperture by having a synthetic telescope. You can actually measure the wavefronts through and synthesize two separate telescopes, two separate ground-based telescopes, having them separate. So you can use computer power to undo the effects of the atmosphere, or to actually do active compensation for it, or you can actually increase the aperture either directly or synthetically. The answer they have said, resolution of a ground-based telescope can be improved by a number of techniques, including active optics, adaptive optics, and interferometry. I think adaptive optics is taking into account sort of the gravitational sag. Optics often uses a slow computer-controlled feedback system to correct for the sagging or deformities of a large primary mirrors in optical telescopes. I really don't technically think you should call it resolution. Interferometry uses data, optical and radio, for a number of collectors to produce interference pattern, which is then mathematically analyzed to produce an unblurred image. Okay, they haven't actually, here in this one, mentioned yet another way, which is just having a larger telescope. So, Galileo had a very small telescope to start off with, and that had low resolution, but he didn't understand that. So he believed that what he was seeing was the actual size of objects. Okay, B1. Explain how the trigonometric parallax is used to determine the distance of a star. So you'd have to use that formula and a diagram that we discussed before. D equals 1 on P. So you'd measure the angle of the star, if possible. But 12 months apart, so this is only stars, unfortunately, which are rare in the ecliptic plane. In the ecliptic plane, which are orbiting, but we won't discuss that. It's all directions, in actual fact. But as it orbits across, you measure the angle between something displaced 6 months of a year, the maximum angle, divide that by 2, and use trigonometry to work out the distance, which, putting into my head, the distance, one half angle, equals tan on D for that. Just have a look at there. Answer. So you have to draw a diagram for that. And reading this through, they have in fact drawn the diagram. Trigonometry can be used to calculate the distance of a relatively close still object, using their apparent change in position with time against a background. Okay, that's a bit. Viewing positions should change as the Earth rotates. The sun every 6 months. Okay, well, they should explain that a bit better. Okay, determine the absolute magnitude of a star, which is Big M, which has an apparent magnitude of 4.2, which is 4.2, and a parallax of 0.55 arc seconds. The D that we're going to use is 1 on the parallax, which is 1 on 20, or sorry, 0.5 is 1 on 20, 0.55, just putting in my head, is about 15 parsecs, 15 on yes, sorry, if it's 1 arc second, so it's, let me see, 1 of 15 around that mark. I may be right about that, just in my head, and you put that into the formula, which is Big M equals little m, which is 4.2. Okay, so it's minus 5 log that quantity divided by 10 parsecs. So we'll just put that through in the formula. We'll just check the answer that they've given for that, which is the next one. Sorry, you can hear my sounds moving. And what they've done is that, using the formula P equals 1 and D, which we had before, equals 18.8 parsecs. And then they have the formula M equals M minus 5 log D on 10, which is 10 minus 5 4.2 minus 4.298, which is 2.9 absolute magnitude of 2.9. So if it's got a smaller absolute magnitude, it's brighter. So the bigger it goes down, the bigger number you have, the dimmer it is. So because it's farther away, you bring it into 10 parsecs away, and it is an actual fact that the absolute brightness is bigger. See, oh no, that's correct, we're on to C. Describe how the spectrum of a star can be used to determine its chemical composition and its surface temperature. So you can determine you've got the spectrum of the star. So you can analyze the spectrum of the star, looking for the position of lines which corresponds to chemicals which occur on Earth, and look up a chart for those chemicals, and you can determine its surface temperature by fitting a black body radiation curve to the overall continuum, and using the law that lambda times the peak wavelength, so the peak wavelength times the temperature is a constant, and we'll just see how they've answered it. That says particles of the atmosphere of a star absorb specific frequencies of light, allowing the elements, the molecules, be identified. Okay, hence the chemical composition can be determined. Okay, well, I have a thing about that, because the actual cloud layer outside the star may be such that it absorbs it, the light coming through. These are the absorption line. You've also got the emission lines, which give you the things closer. It gives you the chromosphere. It's a bit closer to it, it's relating those absorbed frequencies. It just doesn't actually describe how the position of those frequencies tell you the chemical. The presence of molecules, neutral atoms, or ionized atoms in the star determines its temperature. This can be detected in the absorption spectrum, allowing the temperature to be the answer could include information on Wien's law, which is the black body radiation curve. That's extremely confusing. Confusing there, because the absorption occurs on the outer layer of the star. The presence of ions, the presence of ionization lines or ion lines, due to absorption of ions, high ions, does indicate the actual electron temperature at the surface of stars. We won't get into that. I would expect in an exam they would accept the fitting black body curve, it says, as an alternative. Question 4, explain how the study of different types of variable stars has increased our understanding of celestial objects. Well, for 4 marks, a variable star typically is a Cepheid, and a Cepheid, the rate of variation is related to the actual luminosity of the star. So if it's more luminous, I think it, depending on the class of Cepheids, there's, I've forgotten the name of the woman. She's from the Boston, Henrietta Leavitt. Sorry, there's my brain coming back to me quickly. This is amazing, because I've had some time off with pretty heavy anesthetics, pretty heavy recovery, so that's can't come out to me. So the Cepheids give you the absolute magnitude of a star, and therefore the absolute magnitude of a star compared to their apparent magnitude can be put into the formula to tell their distance. Then the other So there's different types. There's different grades of Cepheids. So they're the different types of variable stars. Can tell if there's two or three grades of Cepheids stars. Let's go back to them and say the period of relationships of Cepheid variables allow the distance to Earth to be deduced. Knowing the distance, inferences about celestial objects near the Cepheid can be made, such as the absolute magnitude and relative age of the star. Okay, well, the entire it's the period lumen allows their distances from Earth to be deduced. It allows their absolute magnitude to be deduced, and therefore, okay, that's all confused. Features of binary and multiple star systems, such as orbital periods, mass and relative size can be deduced from their extrinsic variation in brightness. Features of binary and multiple star systems. Okay. Other answers, use of variables to identify exoplanets. So, that would be the variation. So, you wouldn't say that, I mean, this is deeply confused here. You wouldn't say that an exoplanet going in front of a star causes the star to be variable, but it means that the amount of light is variable. I think that's deeply confused there, but for 4 marks it says, explain how the study of different types of variable stars has contributed to the understanding of celestial objects. So they think a variable star is anything where the lightness varies, which is a thing which we normally in astronomy wouldn't say, that a star with a variation in front of it. There's variation for all points of time, but Cepheids is a classic variation stars, and they've got that back to front. Okay, the last question here is to describe how the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram relates to the processes that occur. Describe how the distribution of stars on the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram relates to the process that occurs during their evolution. Okay, so the way you would have to do this is draw a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram with various numbers, and the most important thing is to say that the stars enter the main sequence. So there's pre-main sequence, enter the main sequence, which is either just very slow hydrogen burning, or where it ticks up, you've got the CNO cycle where it ticks up, then that burns there. I'm going to have to go right through it really quickly. That burns for the full sequence lifetime of the star. The process is, okay, there's a protostar, then it evolves into the main sequence. And then it evolves. You have to keep on going. It evolves into a shell, core burning, shell burning, and then different burnings of different things like the helium burning. And this is in the giant phase. And then it will explode, forming a planetary nebula, and go to another point, which is the white dwarfs in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. I haven't explained that very well, but I do have a method in my head of how I'd write that out. And going to the actual final answer that I have written is coming to it. So I've got the formula sheet at the back here. Okay. Now, just reading through this, it is interesting that if you were to just pick up the exam questions, okay, 6 marks relate to the processes occur during of cell evolution to the non-uniform distributions in the HR diagram. Is that related to the actual question? I don't know what they mean by that. Okay, this is the sample answers. Stars on the HR diagram are non-uniformly distributed into distinct groups dependent on the processes which occur during their evolution. The primary source of energy in stars on the main sequence is hydrogen fusion. Okay, the next evolutionary stage for most stars is helium fusion. These are red giants. Okay, you put that. The next evolutionary stage is characterized by gravitational collapse, during which gravitational potential energy is converted to radiant energy. These belong to white dwarfs. Okay, well, in fact, white dwarfs remain white, not because the matter is continuing to fall into them. It's just because the matter is so compressed, it's got a very small surface area. So it's just radiatively cooling. So that's deeply confused there. Next evolutionary stage is characterized by gravitational collapse, during which gravitational potential energy is converted into radiant energy. These belong to a group known as white dwarfs. Well, that's deeply confused. So white dwarfs, there's no fusion going on. There's no energy being produced. And the white dwarfs are not going hot due to gravitational collapse. I'm really deeply embarrassed this is being put out and taught to our Australian kids. But there it goes. So that's basically incorrect. White dwarfs are very so hot, and it's got a slow. They're so massive. So there's huge massiveness, and they have too small surface area to release the heat. So the heat is trapped in by the small surface area. Final paragraph. Since the transition from one process to another occurs quickly relative to the time spent in each group, fewer stars are distributed outside the area. That's a good point. That, you know, it goes in a process and there's no transition. However, the horizontal branch is an example of things changing uniformly. The answers will include reference to other groups such as protostars and supergiants, sketch of the HR diagram, definitely, reference to the properties of stars related to their distribution within a particular group, globular and open clusters. Okay, well, there you go. So that's the overall astrophysics paper. So I do hope it has helped people who have not necessarily been taught the Australian course, that are going over the actual equations first. And I do think it's really powerful going over the equations given first, because it sets you up, refreshes your memory, able to answer them, and it gives you an idea that if you were to do exam revision just raw, going off the with the provided answers, you'd be very misguided, and you ask the question, well, how does this work? If they've got they're teaching and or answering essentially what is an incorrect idea correct, you know, how does it work? How do the top students get the top marks if what they would say is correct would be marked incorrect? Well, the answer is that these particular ideas don't come from physics books or from scientists. It comes from a series of study notes, the people at the top schools get directed to teach, to learn those particular study notes over and over again, and they will in general produce the top marks. It depends how it goes. Look, thanks for listening, and I'll keep this as a method of doing tutorials. It's not as sexy as these more complex topics that people want to learn about, but it's the aim of this is for my cardiac rehabilitation and for the specific audience of the students that I'm trying to teach, which is on so many levels a complex issue, because the information out there is not necessarily correct at different points in the cycle. And that's not to say anyone's particularly to blame, because, say, in different areas I'll look at the actual, their reference material is wrong. You know, even quite up to semi-expert materials that is produced for the general public is wrong. And so in the past, it's taken me a couple of months to research an incorrect answer and bring it up and actually do the full research and take it to authorities in the field overseas to actually really get down to the issue. So it's not necessarily that an answer is incorrect, it's why it's incorrect and how it's in the system, which I think I normally get to, but now I'm in cardiac rehab and not directly teaching students. I'm here doing podcasts, and I can't ethically give you a podcast where I actually tell you the incorrect information. Thanks for listening. Keep on thinking, doing, and finally teaching science. All the best.